The organizer specifically asked me not to give a summary on the grounds that the talks we've heard today, or all the talks, or at any rate most of the talks, have been so clear and everybody's been paying so much attention that you don't need me to summarize what's been said, or anybody else for that matter. And I, for one, I was very happy to accept the instructions of the organizers, because as I've learned in the last few years, there's no better way to lose one's few remaining friends than trying to give summaries at conferences. So I'm not going to try and summarize the conference. Instead, I'm going to try and do what the organizer asked me to do, and that was to moderate a structured discussion on the question of where do we go from here. And I have actually prepared a set of questions that in a way encapsulate what I think are the highlights of the meeting, and do tell us, address this question to some extent. Before I put up those questions for discussion, clearly, before we can answer the question of where do we go from here, it's useful to know where we are. And I am going to spend a few minutes just making some, as I said, fairly toothless comments of a general nature that are certainly not provocative, because in fact the people I would have provoked have probably already left anyway. And these are just a set of general remarks, really, of where we are and what are we trying to do. Now, it's 20 years since Sefcovic made his famous prophecy, but all people here with white hair have seen this many times, probably the younger people too, but in case they haven't, I wrote it here at a meeting, at a symposium in 1979 in Tallinn. Concluding the symposium, Sefcovic said that extrapolating to the next symposium somewhere in the early 80s, one can be pretty sure that the question of the formation of galaxies and clusters will be solved in the next few years. Now, Simon White and I organized a meeting on galaxy formation in November in London. I showed this view graph as well, kind of trying to imply that he was really off the mark. And in his concluding remarks, however, Simon made a very interesting comment, namely that it's not at all obvious that if Sefcovic was still alive, that he would still think there is a problem to be solved in the question of galaxy formation. And I'll come to that in a second, but I don't want to belabor this point that's pretty obvious. What one means by solving galaxy formation is a subjective concept. In fact, clearly, galaxy formation is not a sort of mathematical problem that you solve. It is the existence of galaxies, obviously, is a natural phenomenon, and what we're trying to do is gain some understanding of that natural phenomenon, and the level of understanding that one wants to acquire is subjective and depends on your viewpoint. Now, at the beginning of the meeting, David Gross told us that our subject reminded him of the state of particle physics in the 1970s, where there was a standard paradigm, and the paradigm soon was shown to be consistent with all the data, and then particle physics split into two directions, sort of speculative component that I guess led to strings and things like that, and another area of phenomenology. And he remarked that he felt that galaxy formation was pretty much at the stage of having a paradigm, which if it wasn't completely confirmed yet, would soon be, and predicted that our subject would go the same way of particle physics. And I really hope that Sefcovic, I don't know if Sefcovic was right or wrong, but I do hope David Gross was completely wrong. Nevertheless, there is certainly a current of opinion, a viewpoint that is not particularly well represented in this audience, because this is an Institute for Theoretical Physics, so this meeting is dominated by theorists, which is a very refreshing thing. But nevertheless, there is a current of opinion that feels that the issue of galaxy formation is really an empirical question that is going to be understood just by lots of observation, getting lots of keck time, and essentially observing galaxies at various stages of evolution, and that is going to give us understanding, perhaps with just a modicum of theoretical input. Now, I personally don't think that this is a particularly fruitful viewpoint, perhaps a bit of a stereotype, but to me it's quite clear that a satisfactory understanding of galaxy formation is going to require a combination of theory and observations. So I just want to make a few general comments inspired by some of the questions that have come up during the meeting on the theory of galaxy formation and how it interacts with the data. Now, it seems to me, just on general grounds, any theory for galaxy formation needs to deal with three major questions. It needs to tell us or measure the material content of the universe. It needs to have some mechanism for generating initial conditions and some description of the processes that transform the initial conditions into galaxies. Only when you meet these three requirements can you say you have a theory or a model. And of course, we do have a paradigm, which is the standard cold dark matter paradigm. And in fact, this is really the only game in town. This is the only theory or model that we have that makes specific suggestions for these three key elements. We have other ideas. We have scenarios like monolithic collapse, but they are not theories or models in the sense that the standard cold dark matter paradigm is. It assumes, of course, the universe is made of cold dark matter, that the initial conditions come from quantum fluctuations generated during inflation, and they have a particularly simple power spectrum and a Gaussian distribution of amplitude. And the processes that are responsible for galaxy formation are gravitational processes and more complex gas processes involving cooling, star formation, and so on. Now, this basic paradigm has been in place for 20 years. It hasn't changed. The one thing that has changed is the parameters that are needed to specify in detail the model. And one of the depressing things, in a sense, of the last few years is that that beautiful tension we used to have until a couple of years ago between theorists and observers about the values of the parameters has now gone away, and nobody wants to discuss about omega. We've all bought willy-nilly the idea that there's a cosmological constant, we just proceed. And seems to me we buy this, then perhaps not surprising, we also buy the idea that there is cold dark matter. In fact, many people don't even bother telling you that they're talking about cold dark matter theory. To me, that is the main uncertainty in the whole game, that we don't know what the dark matter really is. But we do have a specific prediction, and this specific prediction leads to a very well-defined set of initial conditions, and which implies that galaxies form hierarchically. And it seems to me that even those people who are averse to CDM should be grateful that the subject is blessed with a specific theory that can be used to compute quantities in detail. Now, to many, I mean, perhaps to David Gross or to Seldovich, if we could actually find the dark matter, for example, or measure the power spectrum, that would be it. That's the level of understanding that they would want to have. And if we measure this power spectrum in detail, to many physicists, quite rightly might argue, that is how much they want to understand about the formation of structure. But that's clearly not the case for most of the people in this audience. What we really want to do is gain a much more detailed understanding of the properties and evolution of galaxies. Now, unfortunately, that is not trivial. It's complicated because there are many physical processes that we need to model or understand or gain information empirically. And I've listed just some of those here. This is by no means an exhaustive list of the processes that we need to come to terms with. Of course, we need to understand, first and foremost, the evolution of the dark matter halos, because that is where galaxy formation is happening. We need to understand how gas is shock-heated, cools into these halos, how it turns into stars, whether star formation is quiescent or in bursts, as we discussed at great length at the meeting. Then we need to grapple, really, with the very complex coupling between the stellar fluid and the gas through radiative and hydrodynamic feedback processes. We need to understand the production and mixing of heavy elements, the evolution of stars, the effects of dust, galaxy mergers, how they affect the morphology and structure. I have another view graph with more of these, which I'm not going to show. But I just want to make the point that the problem of galaxy formation involves quite a lot of very uncertain physics and a formidable range of scales, from the scales of individual stars to the scales of the universe as a whole. Oh, David Gross just came. He missed all the bad things instead of him. There's two approaches that have been used theoretically to carry out this program. I was actually quite surprised at this meeting, talking to some fairly intelligent people who didn't seem to really have grasped this key methodological point. There are two techniques that have been designed to carry out this program: M-body gas dynamic simulations and the much maligned semi-analytic modeling, sometimes used in combination with M-bodies. Now, let me put it to you that the two are the same, pretty much. They differ only in minor aspects, and let me tell you, with reference to this, what that minor aspect is. Both the simulations and the semi-analytics, there's no such thing as a semi-analytic model. That does not exist. A semi-analytic tool approach is just a tool to take some power spectrum and extract from it observable consequences in pretty much the same way as a simulation does. Now, what does a simulation do? A simulation simulates or models, calculates directly or explicitly the first two of these processes. An N-body gas dynamic simulations like David Weinberg's, Jerry Oestreicher's, and many others explicitly models these two processes, and all the rest of these processes occur on scales that are impossible to resolve, and so that's what we call in the subject subgrid physics, and are put in some fashion, in a phenomenological way, into the simulation. And we all do that. Many, perhaps some of those don't realize we're doing it, but we all are assuming some model for all these other complex physics. The semi-analytic approach differs in that instead of treating these two processes directly, it only treats the first one explicitly and takes gas dynamics into account, again, as a subgrid, treats it as a sort of subgrid process, using a simple phenomenological model. That is the main difference between those two approaches. And each has, they're complementary. N-body gas dynamic simulations have the advantage that they model the gas explicitly, but the disadvantage is that they're limited by resolution. And so one has to be very wary that resolution effects could have an important influence in the results. Semi-analytics, on the other hand, has the weakness that the gas dynamics are treated in this very simple-minded and almost certainly incorrect spherically symmetric model with cooling time type arguments, but it has the advantage that you don't need to worry about resolution, and you can, for example, follow the formation of individual galaxies. Let's leave that for the discussion. All right. Let's leave that point for later. Now, right, okay. I know what you're saying, Matthias. There's a question. I'm talking really about, of course, you can design special purpose simulations like the ones that you do and the ones that I do, some that really try to zoom on individual galaxies. But the real point I'm making here is that N-body gas dynamic simulations will always be limited by resolution, and that you would agree with that. Good, please take one of these offensive. You will also agree with me that you need to put in this subgrid physics in some fashion. Well, not because it takes a lot of computing time. It takes a lot of computing time to fix it. Anyway, the point, though, is that one needs to have models for all these physics. And I think some people criticize semi-analytics, and the criticism that they should carry over to simulations, that criticizes the number of parameters. I think that is not really an interesting criticism to make. I'm looking at somebody here who was telling me this just last night. I think what one should focus on is the fidelity and the realism with which one is modeling these various processes. I think what is critical is not whether you have parameters. I mean, everybody has parameters. If you don't believe me, standard model of particle physics, for example, which has 19 free parameters. And this is a standard model of particle physics, and just like in galaxy formation, only a few of them are known to better than 1%. And moreover, the standard model of particle physics does not even include gravity, which we of course do. So, so don't talk to me about parameters. Talk to me about physics. And I think the serious point here really is that what one should be focusing on is how realistic are the models that one uses to model these various things. Now, so I'd now like to address another of the issues that came up, and people genuinely ask, well, how can we test all these things? We have this paradigm. If we're going to move into David Gross's universe of phenomenology and speculation, how are we going to know when we check the paradigm? Of course, if you measure the power spectrum or discover the dark matter, then you're done. In the meantime, it's a perfectly legitimate question to ask, are there any generic predictions that one can make? And the answer is yes. Unfortunately, the more generic the predictions, the less testable they are. For example, if you want to make really generic predictions, you really got to ignore all the gas physics and so on, because that is very uncertain, and you can make generic predictions for the dark matter, which are, of course, not very easy to test, but they can test at, be tested at some level. And in fact, we had a lot of discussion of this in the first 2 days of the meeting. I've listed here four generic predictions of the hierarchical clustering picture. They all have to do with dark matter. The first one is we know and we can calculate with great accuracy the mass function of dark matter halos. It's a function that looks like that. Number of halos is a function of mass. It has a steep faint end, a low mass end with a slope of minus 2 or so, much steeper than the galaxy luminosity function. And that's a basic prediction from hierarchical clustering. And the mass function marches along as the universe gets older. We've learned over the last 2 years that the halos have a lot of substructure, and that the substructure itself has a mass function that roughly looks like that. Another very generic prediction of hierarchical clustering is that the dark matter halos should have cusp-y similar density profiles. That is a generic prediction, and we spend a lot of our time on Tuesday talking about ways in which this could be tested. Another important generic prediction has to do with the clustering of the halos, namely that more massive halos are more strongly clustered than less massive halos. Another generic prediction of these sort of pictures. Now, if we now want to make more testable predictions, we have to enter the murky world of gas dynamics, star formation, and so on. You could try and list a few that are not particularly sensitive to the details of the modeling. I've listed some here. One's pretty obvious. Galaxies should have extended dark matter halos. Typical galaxies should have been less massive in the past than they are today, and also smaller. These are all fairly generic, not totally generic. You can make a crazy model within hierarchical clustering that would violate some of these, I'm sure. But if you take the simplest possible assumptions, you do expect galaxies to get smaller as you go into the past and to get slimmer. Galaxies in clusters should be more dynamically advanced than galaxies in the field. Actually, I think a pretty general prediction of hierarchical clustering, obviously with the benefit of hindsight, is there should be two basic morphological types. Let me tell you why. Why I say this. There's a half serious point I'm making there. Let me tell you why. The reason is that in hierarchical clustering, what's very generic is that you have spinning halos. I mean, the tidal torquing is a generic part of hierarchical clustering. Once you have angular momentum, you have disks. All you need to then know is that the gas will turn into stars, and then because they're mergers, you'll conclude that they have to be spheres. Anyway, the final one that I've listed here, which is a much more serious point, and I think it illustrates very nicely one of the basic methodological points I want to make, and that is the properties and distribution of the Lyman alpha forest, which are, I think, fairly generic predictions of the whole picture. Now, going back to the remarks I made earlier as to how we're really going to hope to acquire some meaningful understanding of galaxy formation, I think the subject very nicely illustrates, I think, the way forward and the way in which our studies of galaxy formation are likely to move in the next decade or so. I think everybody would agree that it was the advent of simulations of the intergalactic medium at high redshift that completely changed the understanding and the paradigm and studies of the intergalactic medium at high redshift. And so I think this provides a very good example of how I think the subject will move on in the next few years. But that's what I want to say by way of non-provocative statements. Now, I've listed 10 questions, which I'd like to now put up and for discussion. I've grouped them into four sort of categories, nothing profound about this. The first one, the first category has to do with global issues, things like, it seems to me one of the highlights of this meeting is the fact that we may be beginning to see a coherent, the emergence of a coherent picture that links the Lyman Gray galaxies to the SCUBA sources and to the extragalactic background. There are issues here that are worth discussing. Then issues to do with demographics of elliptical galaxies. Do we really see elliptical galaxies, their abundance changing as a function of redshift, as is predicted by the theory? Questions of the demographics of these galaxies. Again, are these really smaller at high redshift? Are they still forming today? I have a few questions on processes, particularly the vector question of the angular momentum of disks. And then I have a last category of questions to do with dark halos. Do they really have cusps, and how do we go about measuring them? So I don't know what people feel like doing. I'm sure many of you feel like drinking beer, not listening to me, and so I'm going to shut up. But I suggest we start, I just put these two, and I suggest we just switch the lights on and maybe have a discussion, if people still have something to say, about these questions. Yes, Jerry.
Is if you look at almost all of the tests, they're at long wavelengths. So the longest wavelengths are tested by the micro background radiation observation. And then the shorter wavelengths. And it's still fairly good down to less than, in other words, the input power spectrum is still fairly good agreement down to a fraction of a megaparsec. If you add wavelength small compared to that, we have very few tests. And that's why it was extremely interesting when people made recently various proposals for different kinds of dark matter, which would have made no difference on wavelengths longer than that, but would have made differences on wavelengths shorter than that. For example, warm dark matter, interacting dark matter, etc. So a fair question is, how much is the paradigm been tested on small wavelengths? My conclusion from looking at it is that it really is, because you can propose things that are relatively outlandish and have quite a bit of difficulty finding anything to disprove.
Yeah, I mean, I there are people here who I'm sure would like to make comments on this, but all I would say is that on the long wavelengths, well, it's tested at this level until Dick Bond finally tells us what Boomerang saw. Then this is the level, you know, this is from September 99, so there's not much change here. So at this level, the long wavelengths have been tested. And on smaller scales, I think you're being too optimistic, because the galaxy surveys that probe scale, say, of 100 megaparsecs or so, I think they still... But I think there's still a lot of questions there as to, because, you know, we only see the galaxies. And but I would agree with the general sentiment that we are actually converging on measuring this power spectrum.
I agree with David's original point, that we have a more or less standard paradigm, which more or less works, and we're fine-tuning it. And that's on all wavelengths longer than, let's say, half a megaparsec. On all wavelengths shorter than that, and all the physics that's applied on that, I think we have no chance.
I would agree with that. Anybody disagree, or Simon?
Well, I think the best test
counts
will come from the Lyman Gray source, where you saw the data
testing power on scale very small compared to my
part. I think so. That's
No, that's right. But then I think the question is a subjective one. At what level are you satisfied with the understanding that you have? I was saying to Mike Fall last night that I understand the sun. I don't want to know any more about the sun. John Bacall says he doesn't understand the sun, but I do. I don't want to know any more about it. Anyway, now let us... I think there were two highlights in my own personal opinion of the meeting, two things that were really new here, which is my first question and my last question. Maybe we could start discussing this. The first one was that it did seem to me in the discussion yesterday that maybe for the first time in the last two or three years, we're really beginning to paint a global picture where everything is fitting together in terms at least of the formation of stars in the universe. And the question then is, given everything we know about the inferred star formation rate from observations of the UV submillimeter on the one hand, given the constraints from the extragalactic background light on the other hand, is there room for any more star formation? Or have we tracked all the star formation that there is? The very related question is, are the Lyman Bray galaxies and the SCUBA sources just examples of a single population of star forming galaxies at high redshift, where there is some parameter, perhaps the intensity of the star formation that changes along the attendant production of dust that changes along that population, and what do these things turn into today? So I don't know whether people feel that this subject deserves more discussion, and in particular, I think there was a very strong, strong opinions that would say that perhaps there isn't any more room for star formation anymore. And if that is the answer, how do we go about testing this very powerful conclusion? First of all, does anybody have anything to say about the whether this is really a highlight of the meeting and where people agree that maybe we've seen all the stars, all the star formation? Within a factor of two, says Francois right here. And so everybody bought this. Mike, you talked about the backgrounds and that you've thought about this problem.
Whatever and then go the other way around from the total background, subtract out the known sources. Two of these come together, so don't leave very much room for error in between them.
Right. Joel. Yeah, no, I think that that's a very good point. And so I don't know what are the prospects for nailing down these backgrounds at all the wavelengths more precisely than they are known now. But certainly. Does anybody have anything to say about this? Jean-Loup, I thought you would. Yeah. On the second question, I can see most of the observers, well, there's David here, but most of the observers really have run away. Is Amy Barge still here? She's gone. Len's gone. So I don't know if anybody has any opinions on these very nice syntheses that seems perfectly consistent with what we know, namely that everything from Lyman Bray galaxies to Kurt is still here, to scuba sources are just the same thing. And we're just seeing the same phenomenon, just with one physical parameter changing, call it star formation rate, metal production. What do you think, Kurt? Do you have anything? Well, some people say that the SCUBA sources are really, you know, elliptical galaxies information, and the Lyman Bray galaxies are who knows what, just a minor population that you have to have picked up by chance, that they're two separate. I must say, to be honest, I don't quite understand when people say they're two populations, what exactly they mean. I'm interpreting people's thoughts, but their feeling is that, you know, the SCUBA sources are somehow a different type of physical phenomenon. I mean, at some level, they probably, you could argue, you know, maybe the SCUBAs are the mergers and the LBG is something else, the disks. I mean, for example, that perhaps would be, in a sense, a separate population. But the question really is whether they already be, from the point of view of mapping the formation of stars, they should be treated just as galaxies making stars. And just like we see in the local universe, there are galaxies like the Milky Way, and there are things like Arp 220, which have a range of star formation rates, and therefore a range of dust production and so on. Whether that's the sort of phenomenon that we're seeing at high redshift, or that we're genuinely seeing the formation of something quite different. That's why I think I put in here as a supplementary question, what do the things turn into? Because maybe, yep. Exactly. Yes. Mike. All right, but you would have worded the answer the same. Yeah, Joe.
Modest improvement factor of 3, we don't have to go to the full strength of the ALMA detectors. And we're going to know a great deal about this question.
Yeah, I mean, there's two detectors. Scuba 2 is coming along, and then there'll be the LMT. And
right, so there's going to be, I think, steady progress on this. I don't think we need to be pessimistic that we're going to be able to pin down how much light is coming out of the international
space. Daniel. David.
So I want to there's talk a lot about testing the paradigm, and I think that's one of the things that we're interested in doing. And I agree with Jerry, that the main big thing we haven't tested yet is whether on small scale we have what we expect for standard inflation for our matter or whether it's change in power space or change in the properties of dark matter. And certainly a lot of those things aren't ruled out, and we're in your last two points are basically going at, are we driven to them? And it seems to me we're currently in a situation where we're not driven to them, but they're not ruled out, but that's one of the things we should be doing. But the other part of the game is, we want to know why galaxies have the luminosities and sizes and morphologies and mass to light ratios and so forth that they do. And on that part of understanding galaxy formation, it seems to me like we have ideas, but that those ideas are A, not that clear whether they work within this paradigm, and at any rate, they're not very well tested. And so I think that has two implications for the theorists. The one is that we should treasure our failures, because those, I think, are the ones that we're going to learn the most from. Maybe it needs to be done, but maybe we haven't tested anything. And the other is, particularly, this according to an numerical simulation for nuclear and semi-analytics, but to not always sort of proceed with what you think are the best or most sensible assumptions for how you calculate disk sizes or whatever, but to try to really put in radically different assumptions and understand whether you can distinguish those or what you need to do to distinguish those. And there have been some good examples of that come out of semi-analytic work.
Yeah, we're gradually moving to the next part of it. Jerry.
I agree with you. There's two different fronts to it. One is testing from metaphysics, what we understand, what we don't. And the other is applying whatever our understanding is to astronomy. Then can we answer the age-old astronomical question? Unfortunately, there's a methodological issue on the left. We all never read a theologian who didn't understand God and nature evil, or historians didn't understand the periods of their studies. And I can't imagine anyone modeling galaxy formation who doesn't understand galaxy formation. That it doesn't reproduce the observed properties. In other words, because it's all done in these approaches with your eyes quite wide open to the data, and as many handles as you need to quote unquote explain the phenomenon, and it really is like discussing history at that point, you always win in this game.
Let's move away a little bit from the philosophical remarks. We have 10 more minutes. I suggest we spend maybe focus, instead of all these questions, two key questions, and then maybe move on to that other highlight. So the two questions that I like to highlight here. One, the key question for spheroids and the key question in disks. The key question for spheroids, I think, is do we really see the rapid evolution in the abundance of elliptical galaxies with redshift that's predicted by the theory? Are the theories really predicting that in a robust fashion? Why do we get different results? I don't know if Dave Koo's gone, when we look at galaxies, samples selected by morphology versus color. I don't know if Dave Koo is in here, we're probably not going to make much progress there. But the question on disks, the key question really is that the simplest versions of this of the hierarchical clustering theory predicts that this should be still forming today. This is not a subject we discuss much, but it clearly goes to the heart of the whole thing. Is there any evidence that the disks are still forming today? Is there evidence for accretion? We've heard a lot about, not in the meeting, but in the last year or so, or the last 2 years, about high velocity clouds. We know just a simple energetic argument that to make a disk like the Milky Way, we must have dissipated a large amount of energy, which naturally you would expect to see in the X-rays, and we don't seem to see those X-rays. So perhaps we could spend 5 minutes talking about these two issues and then go back to the question, to the other highlight, which was the question of the structure of halos. So any comments to this, Abhishek?
To the standard wisdom of disks going to merge into elliptical. And I think it would be worthwhile to come up with full scenarios and actually cook scenarios up in a way that can be confronted with other scenarios of observation. Then we may learn much more than if we just stick to one scenario and continue along it. Even if we have feelings for one or another.
People are probably getting tired. They want to talk about philosophy. I want to talk about physics. Does anybody have any physics points? Yeah, but I suggest we leave philosophical discussions for dinner, even better for after dinner. Simon, go
ahead. Tell me the two spirals emerge and make M87.
No, but I can tell you the two spirals emerge and make M88 and 72, and that looks like more solid. It has a profile, it has a problem, it has a lot of dispersion and concentration, and you can see a spiral there.
So what's it?
Is that okay? So some of it, because of the main
value, that's a long way to say you make all of it.
There are anomalous ballisticals which have blue counter-rotating cores, and I think they probably have parts of it.
Yeah. Abhi. You're absolutely right. That's I agree, and I would flag these as if somebody's looking for troublemaking issues. Here's one. I think this is a genuine problem.
Yeah.
About one, so that you can't see the X-rays, and
then let the gas.
There's another form of the problem, though, which I think is more effective, and that's the deuterium bonds in gallons is high enough that you have to have added some fresh material. You can't keep on recycling, no matter how you work out the arithmetic.
The most which you're going to go out and then you have to pay it. If it's good, what's it good? But if I do it, would you stop it from the back of the meter? And what is that doing?
Simon and Mike, sir.
We can also address this problem. I think we get where you are number six there in relation to that, because the problem is in the trap simulation, even if it is performing today, you don't have angular momentum to make it larger, and that's because of it at the loss, angular momentum assembly. You take a similar model that does away with that loss, so if you make them by today,
well, and why do we see the disk then? We do see the disk. So maybe it's not too hot, maybe it's too cold, and it's just below the threshold, it's waiting to be discovered.
Well, that's an interesting question. Could that actually be there in the header and the form
section? Yeah, sorry, Mike had his hand up first. Sorry, Jean-Loup, and then we'll go to you. It would be very nice to see a detailed calculation. Jean-Loup. Anatoly, let's have one discussion. Right. Jean-Loup. Jean-Loup just introduced the word that drives me to a beer, magnetic field. So it's 5 o'clock now. We didn't get to this, so I just want to say two words about this because I do think this was the highlight of the meeting. In the spirit of your summarizing in two sentences for Sandy Faber's benefit, who wasn't here the first days of the meeting, I think what was extremely interesting is the realization, the theory again has not changed, but the data seems to have changed, certainly in the question of whether dark matter halos have cusps or cores, and it appears that maybe the rotation curves that had been measured with H1, they have been interpreted incorrectly, the rotation curves that indicated that dark matter halos do need to have cores, and that perhaps, in fact, the data are actually consistent with the presence of cusps, with some disagreements, of course. And then on the question of the substructure, what was new was, as Ben, I think, first pointed out and highlighted, Ben Moore, there is substructure in these halos, and the question is, does the substructure really violate observations? And Simon, in his talk, argued that perhaps the substructure that is predicted in the models is actually consistent with the substructure that we see. I don't want to discuss this further because we come to 5 o'clock, and I need to, in fact, but it is clearly a subject for discussion. I was actually going to thank the organizer of the meeting, but in the light of Rocky, this offense to Rocky Cole, who's a very good friend of mine, I'm not sure I still want to thank the organizers. I will tell Rocky what Martin Henholz thinks of him, but I would, in fact, like to bring this to a close, but not without first thanking the organizers of the meeting. They are listed in the program as in some order that as being Martin Henholz, Lars Henquist, Winnebier Kaufman, Avi Lev, and Simon White. Now, I know that the distribution of weight was not equal amongst these organizers, but nevertheless, I'd like to thank all of them, in particular Winnevere, Martin, and Simon for... sorry, Avi and Lars as well, for... oh, good, okay. And I would really like to say, I think the meeting has been a tremendous success. The people who are participating in the program had expressed some reservations about having a meeting. We were having such a good time working while it was raining here. I think any reservation anybody had, I'm sure, would have been dissipated by what has genuinely been an extremely exciting and lively conference with plenty of new results and fantastic talks. And I would also like to thank the ITP for its hospitality, the staff, of course, David Gross, director of the ITP, and all the staff that have really made this meeting work in a fantastic way. Somebody commented actually that the food was reminiscent of the food we sometimes have in conference in Italy, and that is a great compliment. Although I don't understand, this is the only place in the world actually where people heat the outdoors. You know, coming from England, where people don't even heat the indoors there, it seems to be very odd that in the middle of summer you'd like to heat the outdoors, but that's the way it is. And I would now like all of us to express our appreciation to the organizers, David Gross, Doreen Iverson, and the other staff at the ITP for having arranged this fantastic conference.